Disc 2. The NMDA receptor, a complex receptor. The NMDA receptor is the most common of the three types of glutamate receptors found on neuron membranes in the brain. Consequently, we know the most about this type of receptor, or LOCK. Essentially, it acts as the gatekeeper of a special cell membrane pore called a calcium channel. This channel, or pore, regulates the entry of calcium into the inside of the neuron. The channel is opened when the neuron is activated by the neurotransmitter glutamate, the specific key. Aspartate can also open this calcium channel. So far, we have learned that receptors and transmitters act like locks and keys. But in the case of the NMDA receptor, more than one key is required. It is sort of like a door in a New York apartment, as it takes a lot of keys to open. The other locks on the membrane include a zinc receptor, a magnesium receptor, and a glycine receptor. Zinc can only lock the door. It closes the calcium channel tight. Magnesium also locks the door, but there is an important difference between the two. The zinc blockade of the calcium channel remains even if the neuron is fired, whereas the magnesium blockade is automatically released when the neuron fires. On the other hand, glycine, another amino acid, is absolutely necessary for the calcium channel to open. Experimentally, when glycine is removed from a culture of nerve cells, no concentration of glutamate can make the nerve cell fire. But when glycine is added, the neurons become much more sensitive to excitotoxin activation, and if unrelieved, they are eventually destroyed. Once the neurotransmitter glutamate comes into contact with the receptor, it slides into the lock, the glutamate receptor, like a perfectly fitting key. Then glycine is inserted into its lock close by. When normal levels of magnesium and low levels of zinc are present near the neuron, the channel will then open wide, and calcium and sodium will pour into the neuron, causing it to fire. It's much like the fail-safe system for the launch of nuclear missiles. It takes more than one key to activate the system, and these keys must be inserted and turned simultaneously. Glutamate receptors in the brain. Neuroscientists have discovered that glutamate is one of the most common neurotransmitters in the brain. Its role is primarily that of an excitatory substance. That is, it causes the brain to be stimulated, much the way cocaine does. Using biochemical mapping techniques, we now know that many areas of the brain, such as the cortex, striatum, hippocampus, hypothalamus, thalamus, cerebellum, and the visual and auditory system, all contain an extensive network of glutamate-type neurons. This means that glutamate is involved in a wide variety of brain functions. It has also been demonstrated that activation of cortical glutamate neurons can in turn activate other neurons within the nuclei located deep within the brain, even those not using glutamate as a neurotransmitter. The importance of these connections will become obvious when we examine excitatory amino acids and neurological diseases. After studying a number of brains specifically stained for these special receptors, scientists determined that the glutamate receptor is located on the cell body of the neuron and its dendrite, on the fibers emanating from the neuron cell body like the branches of a tree. Most are located on the dendrite. Being excitatory transmitters, glutamate and aspartate both are involved in activating a number of brain systems concerned with sensory perception, memory, orientation in time and space, cognition, and motor skills. It is important to appreciate that the brain is an organ that depends on a delicate balance of excitatory and inhibitory systems, that is, positive and negative impulses. Disruptions of this balance can lead to anything from a minor tremor of the hands to an uncontrollable writhing motion of the body, or even the violent explosion of a full-blown seizure. In the living organism, a balance of positive and negative systems is all important. Chapter 3. Exciting Cells to Death. In 1908, Dr. Kakune Ikeda, a chemist working in a laboratory at the Imperial University of Tokyo, made a most remarkable discovery that would eventually lead to a multi-billion dollar industry. He was trying to isolate the chemical that was responsible for the taste-enhancing properties of the seaweed known as kombu, or sea tangle. The Japanese had used this seaweed-based flavor enhancer in their recipes for thousands of years. It had the uncanny ability to enhance greatly the flavor of almost any food to which it was added. Fortunately, Dr. Ikeda had received training in Germany, under the tutelage of a famous chemist, Dr. Wolf, who had perfected the technique for isolating glutamate from proteins. To his surprise, Dr. Ikeda found that the mysterious flavor-enhancing ingredient of the seaweed was glutamate. In 1909, Professor Ikeda joined with his friend, Dr. Savrosuke Suzuki, in forming a company which would manufacture this incredible taste enhancer in the form of monosodium glutamate. They named their company Ajinomoto, which translates to the essence of taste in English. By 1933, Japanese cooks were using over 10 million pounds of this taste enhancer every year. They found that it made even the blandest recipes taste scrumptious. During the war, the Japanese government added MSG to their soldiers' rations. Unlike American rations, theirs tasted delicious. American soldiers, having obtained some of the rations from their Japanese prisoners, returned with stories of this delicious-tasting military food. This then led to an investigation by the American military. In 1948, a meeting was held by the quartermasters of the armed forces in conjunction with most of the major food manufacturing giants in America. The list of names of those attending this meeting reads like a who's who of American food manufacturing, including such names as Pillsbury, Oscar Mayer, Libby, Stokely, Campbell Soups, Continental, General Foods, and Borden's. During these discussions, it was concluded that this Japanese taste enhancer did indeed have some remarkable properties. It suppressed undesirable flavors, gave zest to food, removed the tinny taste of canned foods, and turned bland foods into gourmet meals. In short, it held the possibility of a financial boom for the food industry. Following this remarkable discovery, the American food industry drastically increased the amount of MSG being added to prepared foods, which has since doubled every decade since the late 1940s. Today, MSG is added to most soups, chips, fast foods, frozen foods, ready-made dinners, and canned goods. And it has been heaven-sent for the diet food industry, since many of the low-fat foods are practically tasteless. As Dr. George Schwartz has pointed out in his remarkable book, In Bad Taste, The MSG Syndrome, often MSG and related toxins are added to foods in disguised forms. For example, among the food manufacturers' favorite disguises are hydrolyzed vegetable protein, natural flavorings, and spices. Each of these may contain from 12% to 40% MSG. Hydrolyzed vegetable protein is a special case and deserves a closer look. If you will recall, the manufacturing process, as described in the introduction, is a series of chemical processes, first boiling vegetables in sulfuric acid for several hours, then neutralizing the acid with a caustic soda, an alkalizing agent often used to make soap, and then drying the resulting brown sludge. Additional MSG may be added as well to the fine brown powder. The result is marketed as hydrolyzed vegetable protein. When particular amino acids are combined with the basic hydrolyzed vegetable protein, they can bring out a beefy taste that makes it useful in barbecue sauces and fast foods. Other protein combinations bring out a creamy taste that is frequently used in canned and instant soups, salad dressings, and sauces. Analysis of this taste-enhancing substance reveals some interesting findings. Not only does it contain three very powerful brain cell toxins, glutamate, aspartate, and cysteic acid, but it also contains several known carcinogens, cancer-causing substances. Incredibly, the FDA does not regulate the amount of carcinogens allowed in hydrolyzed vegetable protein, or the amount of hydrolyzed vegetable protein allowed to be added to food products. As we shall see later, this substance poses an even greater danger than MSG itself. Excitotoxins, too much of a good thing. By the early 40s, it was known that the human brain normally contained relatively large concentrations of the amino acid glutamate, which at that time was thought to act primarily as a brain fuel. Based on this idea, in 1949, Dr. Vile Mollerby tested a group of mentally retarded children to see if glutamate would improve their mental capacity. Fortunately, as it turned out, the experiment was a failure. I say this because had the experiments continued, greater injury to these children's brains would have eventually occurred. Then in 1957, two ophthalmology residents, Lucas and Newhouse, tested monosodium glutamate and aspartate on infant suckling and adult mice while studying a particular eye disorder. What they found came as a complete surprise. After completing the experiment, they sacrificed the animals and examined their tissues under the microscope. Of the animals that had been tested with monosodium glutamate, virtually all of the nerve cells in the inner layer of the animal's retinas had been destroyed. The worst damage occurred in the newborn mice, but even the adults showed significant injury. they found that the amino acid aspartate caused similar, though less severe, damage. Keep in mind that aspartate is one of the main ingredients in NutraSweet, the artificial sweetener. Unfortunately, this important finding went virtually unnoticed by the medical world, and especially by the food industry, which at the time was adding tons of MSG to foods, including baby foods. It wasn't until 10 years later that someone saw the importance of this discovery. That person was a neuroscientist, Dr. John W. Olney. In 1968, Dr. Olney, working out of the Department of Psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis, repeated Dr. Lucas and Newhouse's experiment using the same kinds of animals and the same doses of MSG. But what Dr. Olney found was even more shocking. He discovered that not only did MSG cause severe damage to the neurons in the retina of the eye, but that it also caused widespread destruction of neurons in the hypothalamus and other areas of the brain adjacent to the ventricular system, called the circumventricular organs. Again, this damage was most severe in the immature or newborn animals. He hypothesized that this area of the brain was affected most because it did not have a blood-brain barrier system to protect it from toxic substances circulating in the blood. Despite the fact that his findings were confirmed in a number of animal studies using a wide variety of species, few paid attention to this critical discovery. The medical journals read by most practicing doctors, especially those caring for newborn babies, neglected to publish his findings. Private practicing physicians, at the time of this discovery, rarely read the basic science research literature and were therefore unaware of the immediate dangers to their patients, especially to newborns and developing babies. Without a public or professional outcry, the food industry continued to add more and more monosodium glutamate and hydrolyzed vegetable protein to foods. And at the time of Dr. Olney's report, even baby foods contained relatively large doses of MSG. Mothers, unaware of the danger to their children, were delighted to see their little ones eating so well. Because MSG and hydrolyzed protein are such powerful taste enhancers, they make most foods, even the bland ones, taste scrumptious. The discovery by Dr. Olney was particularly important because the hypothalamus plays such an important role controlling so many areas of the body. This little piece of brain, no larger than the fingernail of your little finger, controls a multitude of systems, regulating growth, the onset of puberty, most of the endocrine glands, appetite, sleep cycles, and waking patterns, the biological clock, and even consciousness itself. Dr. Olney's studies on various species of test animals disclosed that MSG, when fed in doses similar to those found in human diets, destroys hypothalamic neurons. This type of hypothalamic damage produces a particular syndrome in animals, which caused them to be short in stature, obese, and to have reproductive problems. Later experiments demonstrated that MSG could cause the hypothalamus to secrete excessive amounts of a reproductive hormone called luteinizing hormone, which is associated with an early onset of puberty. Many of these endocrine effects did not appear until the animal was much older. This will be covered in greater detail in Chapter 4. Excitotoxins and the developing brain. Recognizing the immediate danger to the public, especially to the unborn child, Dr. Olney and others testified before Congress concerning these dangers. As a result of their vigilance, MSG was voluntarily removed from baby foods in 1969. But no one had warned pregnant women of the danger to their developing babies caused by the MSG found within their own food. This danger would exist if the glutamate from the mother's blood entered the blood of their unborn baby. In 1974, Dr. Olney demonstrated that MSG, when fed to pregnant rhesus monkeys, could cause brain damage to their offspring. Other researchers found similar results when pregnant rats were fed MSG. Yet millions of pregnant women continued to eat foods laced with MSG and other equally potent excitotoxins, while the FDA remained silent, and gynecologists and pediatricians were not told to warn their patients of this real danger. After birth and following weaning from bottled or breast milk, most mothers begin feeding their babies food from the table. These foods frequently contain large amounts of MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Dr. Olney found that these children were receiving doses of MSG from the table food that equaled the dose used experimentally to produce severe brain cell destruction in animal experiments. By that, I mean proportionally equal. Often, critics of this observation claim that humans rarely receive such high doses. This is just not true. Incredibly, humans develop higher blood levels of glutamate following ingestion of MSG than does any other animal species known. Dr. Olney noted that the amount of MSG in a single bowl of commercially available soup is probably enough to cause blood glutamate levels to rise higher in a human child than levels that predictably cause brain damage in immature animals. When adult humans are fed 100 to 150 milligrams per kilogram of body weight of MSG, their blood levels rise 20 times higher than normal, as compared to a fourfold rise seen in experimental mice fed a comparable dose. Monkeys develop a zero-fold rise in blood glutamate after similar doses of glutamate. We know that children are frequently exposed to doses of MSG and other related excitotoxins in their food in extremely high doses. But the fact that humans concentrate glutamate in their blood to a greater degree than other animal species means that the parts of the human infant's brain not protected by the blood-brain barrier is exposed to even higher doses following MSG or hydrolyzed vegetable protein ingestion than is used experimentally to produce brain damage in animals. And it should be noted, the child's brain is 4 times more sensitive than is the adult brain to these toxins. A survey of children's diets indicated that they often consume the same amounts of MSG as adults. This is especially true with the large number of junk foods and fast foods containing massive amounts of MSG and other excitotoxin taste enhancers, such as chips, frozen dinners, canned pasta, and diet drinks containing aspartate. When my own children were small toddlers, my wife and I were amazed at how much they loved a special canned pasta dish called ABCs and 123s by Chef Boyardee. These are little pasta alphabet letters and numbers in a mixture of tomato sauce. Our children wanted it for every meal. Once I became aware of the danger of MSG, I discovered that this delicious meal in a can contained both MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein. No wonder they loved it. We began to examine our children's food and discovered that many foods specifically advertised for children contained large doses of such excitotoxin taste enhancers. Dr. Olney astutely pointed out the irony of this food industry practice. Thus, today, we are witnessing an ironic situation. While knowledgeable neuroscientists are fervently attempting to develop methods protecting CNS, brain neurons, against neurotoxic potential of endogenous glutamate, and aspartate, other elements of society are vigorously promoting the unlimited use of exogenous glue and asp as food additives. Today, the experimental evidence demonstrating the neurotoxic potential of these excitotoxins is so overwhelming, as can be seen from the scientific citations in this book, that it can no longer be ignored. How excitotoxins work. The studies showing how excitotoxins work have greatly increased our understanding, not only of brain function, but also of the very basis of the degenerative brain disease process itself. In this discussion, you must keep in mind that the excitotoxins added to food are the exact same ones that produce experimental brain damage in animals, and the glutamate in our discussion is the same substance and active ingredient found in MSG. The neurotoxin aspartate is a major component in the artificial sweetener aspartame, usually a mixture of 2 amino acids, phenylalanine and aspartate, and methanol, or wood alcohol. As I said earlier, glutamate and aspartate are neurotransmitters, the keys, found normally in the brain and spinal cord. And even though they are two of the most common transmitter chemicals in the brain and spinal cord, when their concentrations rise above a critical level, they can become deadly toxins to the neurons containing glutamate receptors, the LOCs, and to the nerve cells connected to these neurons. This latter point is especially important. What it means is that excessive glutamate will not only kill the neurons with the receptors for glutamate, but it will also kill any neurons that happen to be connected to it, even if that neuron uses another type of receptor. This will become important when we discuss Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. Both glutamate and aspartame can cause neurons to become extremely excited, and, if given in large enough doses, they can cause these cells to degenerate and die. It is for this reason that the nervous system carefully controls the concentration of these 2 amino acids in the fluid surrounding the neurons, called the extracellular space. It does this by several methods, the most important of which is a system designed to remove any excess glutamate from this extracellular space. This is accomplished by a special pumping system that transfers the excess glutamate back into surrounding glial cells. Glial cells surround the neurons and supply them with energy. This pump acts like a bilge pump on a ship. If the pump fails, the ship fills up with water and sinks. Normally, the glutamate clearing system is very efficient. This is one possible reason why, experimentally, it takes higher doses of MSG to fatally damage the neurons of adult animals than infant animals. The adult glutamate system may be more competent. But remember, even small doses can damage these neurons without actually killing them. While this pumping system is very effective, it requires an enormous amount of cellular energy in the form of the energy molecule ATP, or adenosine triphosphate, for its operation. It is sort of like the old-time fire brigade, where a line of people hoisted buckets down a human chain to put out a fire. It required a lot of energy on the part of the people making up the bucket brigade. If they ran out of energy, the fire would rage out of control. The same thing happens when energy production is reduced in the brain. The protective pumps begin to fail, and glutamate begins to accumulate in and around the neuron, including in the area of the synapse. If the energy is not restored, the neurons, in essence, will burn up. They are literally excited to death. A double whammy. Within 15 to 30 minutes after being exposed to high doses of MSG, neurons suspended in tissue culture are seen to swell like balloons. Under the microscope, you can see degeneration of the small structures within the cell, called organelles, and also clumping of the chromatin of the nucleus. Within 3 hours, these neurons are not only dead, but the body's defense mechanisms begin to haul away the debris. Under experimental conditions using animals, this degenerative reaction is seen when MSG is either ingested in the diet, injected into the abdominal cavity, or applied directly to the neurons in tissue culture, or into the brain by way of cannula or tube. But when lower doses of MSG were used, scientists discovered something very strange and different. Most of the neurons after 30 minutes appeared to be not only unharmed, but perfectly normal in every way. Then, suddenly, 2 hours following the exposure, long after the MSG had been removed, the neurons began to die. It was as if a clock had been set so that the neurons would all commit suicide at the same time. Within 18 to 24 hours after exposure to MSG, all of the neurons were dead. But during that initial 2-hour period, the cells appeared to be perfectly healthy. It became obvious to scientists that these two reactions, the acute and the delayed, must have different mechanisms of action. The acute reaction closely resembled neuron injuries caused by a sudden influx of sodium to the inside of the cell. This rapid movement of salt into the cell's interior would literally suck water inside and cause it to balloon and die. To test this hypothesis, scientists added MSG to a culture of sensitive neurons, but they removed the sodium from the bath medium. They found that no matter what concentration of MSG they used, the cells would not die during that critical 2-hour period. It was concluded that MSG kills neurons acutely by allowing excess sodium, and thus water, to enter the cell. Yet removing the sodium had no effect on the delayed reaction. After 2 hours, the neurons still died. From earlier studies, scientists knew that sodium entered cells by a special microscopic channel or pore that was controlled by special triggering chemicals. Apparently, glutamate acted as a trigger that opened the sodium channel on the cell membrane. This led them to consider another channel that might explain the delayed reaction. They repeated the experiment, but this time they removed calcium from the tissue medium. Anxiously, they waited. 2 hours passed, and the neurons still appeared healthy. 24 hours later, they were still perfectly normal. Calcium, it appeared, was the culprit. Apparently, glutamate opened a special channel designed to allow calcium to enter the neuron, and it was calcium that triggered the cell to die. But how? Calcium and cell death. It has been known for some time that many cells, especially neurons, contain special pores or channels that regulate the entry of calcium into the cell. These special pores are named calcium channels. These channels play an important role in the normal functioning of the neurons. In fact, it is thought that the calcium channels play a vital role in activation of neurons and transmission of their impulses. When a neurotransmitter, the chemical messenger or key, comes into contact with the receptor, the lock, on the neuron fiber's membrane, the calcium channel opens and the inflowing calcium triggers the neuron to fire or be activated. Normally, this opening and closing of the calcium channel is carefully regulated. When stimulated, this channel opens for only a fraction of a second, allowing minute amounts of calcium to enter the neuron. Like glutamate concentrations outside the cell, calcium concentrations inside the cell are carefully controlled by special protective mechanisms. Should too much calcium enter the cell, Special calcium pumps drive the excess back out of the neuron. Some of the calcium is also captured and stored within the endoplasmic reticulum of the cell, a long wavy structure within the cytoplasm. It appears that several of the excitotoxins, including glutamate and aspartate, work by opening calcium channels, at least on certain subtypes of receptors. When these neurotransmitters are allowed to come into contact with the receptor in too high a concentration or for too long a period of time, the calcium channel gets stuck in the open position, allowing calcium to pour into the cell in large amounts. When this happens, the protective mechanisms are triggered. But as with the glutamate pumps, the calcium pumps also require large amounts of energy as ATP. This energy must be supplied continuously, especially if the calcium continues to enter in large amounts and for a prolonged period of time. Again, it is like bailing out a boat that has a large hole in the bottom. To keep from sinking, you must bail the water out faster than it flows into the boat. If you have ever been in this position, you know that it takes a lot of energy to do this. So, how does calcium actually kill the cell? This is an area of intense research and interest because these calcium channels appear to play an important part in a multitude of seemingly unrelated diseases, such as strokes, heart attacks, arthritis, brain injury, migraine headaches, and cancer. Intracellular relay games. In order for the nervous system to function properly, not only must information be passed from neuron to neuron, but there must also be a system whereby information can be transferred into the cells and among the various parts inside the cell. As with communication in the brain, this language is spoken in chemical linguistics. Special chemicals are used to carry messages around the inside of the cell. This is called the second messenger system. Actually, there are third and even fourth messengers. You can think of these chemicals as runners in a relay race, passing the baton from one runner to the next. Once calcium enters the cell, it activates one of these messengers called protein kinase C. This runner, in turn, causes more calcium to be released from a special calcium storage site within the cell called the endoplasmic reticulum. As a result, even more calcium pours into the cytoplasm of the cell. There is also evidence that protein kinase C alters the membrane calcium channel, causing it to be stuck in the open position. As a result, calcium continues to pour into the interior of the cell. All of this excess calcium then triggers a special enzyme within the cell called phospholipase C. This enzyme breaks down some of the fatty acids that make up the cell membrane. Fats are made up of building blocks, called fatty acids, much like proteins are made of amino acids. One of these fat building blocks, called arachidonic acid, is released during this reaction. Arachidonic acid can cause great harm to the cell's interior when it accumulates in high concentrations. Things get really complicated at this point. You are now, no doubt, getting some idea as to the complexity of the brain. The newly released arachidonic acid then is attacked by two different enzymes, called lipoxygenase and cyclooxygenase. Once this occurs, a series of destructive reactions takes place that resemble falling dominoes. Some of the chemical products produced by these reactions can bring about rapid cell death. A cascade of destruction, the free radicals. Once this cascade of destruction is triggered by the influx of calcium, the whole process proceeds with the explosiveness of a nuclear chain reaction. As the reaction proceeds, a particular breed of nasty particles called free radicals is produced. To the biochemist, free radicals consist of any atom, molecule, or group of atoms with an unpaired electron in its outer orbit. A better way to visualize this is to think of them as a shower of red-hot particles that can damage anything they touch. Once released, they bounce all over the inside of the cell, burning holes in everything, even the genes. Actually, they destroy the cell by reacting with other chemicals within the cell. It is important to understand free radicals, because they play such a central role in almost every injury and disease known, from arthritis to cancer, and even aging itself. But free radicals are produced not only during disease or injury, but also during every minute of the day, in the course of normal cellular metabolism. Energy is normally produced in the cells by a complicated breakdown of the simple sugar glucose. During this breakdown process, called metabolism, free radicals are inadvertently produced. They are in tiny quantities, but they are there nonetheless. Two of the most important free radicals are the superoxide radical and the hydroxyl radical. Of these two, the hydroxyl radical is the most potent. also present in abundant amounts, is a substance you might recognize called hydrogen peroxide. That's right. It is the same stuff some people bleach their hair with or use for cuts and scrapes. While hydrogen peroxide is not a free radical itself, it can generate the extremely destructive hydroxyl radical. Normally, these free radicals are produced in minute quantities during energy metabolism by the cells. If nothing were done about them, they would eventually accumulate in high concentrations and begin destroying cells. This is why the cells must have a way to protect themselves. Nature's sponges. Fortunately, the body has a method of neutralizing these nasty particles. This system uses a set of compounds called free radical scavengers, or antioxidants. Essentially, they are like little sponges that can soak up these harmful chemicals. The most important antioxidants are alpha-tocopherol, or vitamin E, and ascorbic acid, also known as vitamin C. The brain normally contains one of the highest concentrations of vitamin C in the body. Unfortunately, it has lower levels of vitamin E. The advantage of these antioxidants is that they can easily enter the blood-brain barrier and reach the brain cells where they are needed most. This means that you can increase the level of these antioxidants in your brain through your diet or by taking vitamin supplements. There is another system the brain uses to guard against free radicals. This involves three enzymes called catalase, superoxide dismutase, and glutathione peroxidase. The bad news is that the brain contains only small quantities of these protective enzymes. This leaves the brain quite vulnerable to free radicals produced by disease, toxins, and injury. As a result, the brain depends on vitamin E and C for its protection. There are also other antioxidants normally supplied by the diet. Most are vitamins, but some are minerals. Beta-carotene is a very powerful antioxidant. Others include vitamins K, D, A, and the minerals magnesium, chromium, zinc, and selenium. The common link. One of the age-old quests of science has been to find the unifying principle that will explain all phenomena. For physics, this is represented by the unified field theory, which was supposed to explain all forces in nature. Thus far, no such unifying principle has been found for biology and medicine. But we are moving closer. One of the most interesting discoveries is the central role calcium channels play in disease, injury, and aging. For a multitude of human disorders, cancer, arthritis, inflammation, injury, strokes, heart attacks, kidney diseases, and even the aging process, calcium channels appear to play a central role. Even many poisons appear to act via calcium channels. Drugs that block calcium channels can often neutralize certain poisons that attack the liver. It used to be thought that when the brain was injured, say from a blow on the head, all of the damage to the brain occurred at the moment of impact. But we now know that much of the ultimate brain damage that will result occurs hours after the accident. It is delayed. All of these changes I have discussed so far occur in the injured brain. Glutamate accumulates in the brain, calcium channels are opened, and calcium pours into the brain cells. This, in turn, sets up the chain reactions involving destructive enzymes and free radicals. As a result, millions of brain cells will eventually die that might have survived otherwise. All of this during the ambulance ride to the hospital and during the first few days of hospitalization. This is referred to as secondary damage. Experimentally, it has been shown that following a brain injury, the ascorbic acid, vitamin C, levels in the brain begin to fall rapidly. It is hypothesized that this occurs because, as an antioxidant, vitamin C is being used up, fighting free radicals that develop as a result of the initial brain injury. Within 24 hours, the brain's level of ascorbic acid falls to barely detectable levels. This leaves the brain vulnerable to further free radical attack. Once the brain has exhausted its supply of antioxidants, it can no longer protect itself from the enormous amounts of free radicals being generated. We know that following an injury to the brain, the metabolism of the entire body speeds up rapidly. This acts as a continuous generator of free radicals. As a result, the brain's supply of antioxidants is quickly exhausted, creating a condition where the body has a critical need for more antioxidants. The same is true of any injury to the nervous system, whether it is a stroke, infection, or chronic degenerative disease. Such patients should be given extra doses of vitamin C, E, and the other antioxidant vitamins and minerals. Chemical hitmen. The excitotoxins do not kill brain cells. They are very selective. They can totally destroy some brain cells and leave other cells adjacent to them completely unharmed. This selective killing is based on the presence of special receptors for glutamate on some neurons and not on others. That is, the cells that will be killed have been marked for death. We know that almost all excitotoxins act by attaching to the glutamate receptors on the membranes. For example, aspartate, as well as glutamate, stimulates neurons by attaching to this receptor. Thus far, we have learned that there are three types of glutamate receptors, called NMDA, quisqualate, and kinate receptors. The most common is the NMDA receptor. Overall, the mammalian brain utilizes glutamate as a neurotransmitter in about 50% of the forebrain synapses. They play a very important excitatory role in brain function. That is, they activate the brain and prepare it for action. Because these receptors are concentrated in specific brain areas known to be affected in certain chronic brain diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease, ALS, Huntington's disease, etc., it has been proposed that excitotoxins may play a central role in these disorders, as we shall see in chapters 5 and 6. In general, we would expect a brain toxin to affect all brain cells equally. But now that we have identified toxins that can act only on specific cells, a whole new understanding of these brain diseases has presented itself. Based on this new knowledge, we may, for the first time, be able to treat diseases that before were considered incurable. But even more exciting, this opens up a whole new field of treatments designed to prevent disease. Excitotoxins and brain cell energy. In 1989, Dr. R.C. Henneberry and co-workers demonstrated that when neurons were deficient in energy, they became much more sensitive to the toxic effect of glutamate and other excitotoxins. Using neurons from the cerebellum of the brain, they found that when magnesium and glucose were present in a tissue culture medium, that is, brain cells suspended in a glass container, even high levels of glutamate, levels as high as 5 millimoles, did not cause cell death. But if the glucose was removed, doses a fraction of this, as low as 0.02 millimole, could cause cell destruction. When magnesium was also removed from the tissue bath, even small doses of glutamate could kill the cells. Remember, magnesium helps keep the calcium channel closed so as to protect the cells. In this experiment, it didn't matter what caused the cell's energy failure, lack of oxygen, low glucose, or metabolic poisons. The effect was the same. The neurons were made extremely sensitive to the toxic effects of glutamate merely because energy was in short supply. Later, Henneberry found that low cell energy reserves by itself could cause the neuron to fire spontaneously, which then relieved the magnesium blockade of the calcium channel, thus allowing calcium to pour into the neuron. It is important to remember that magnesium only blocks the calcium channel in NMDA type of receptors, and not the quisqualate and kinate type receptors. The calcium channel activation appears to be directly linked only to the NMDA type receptor, and not the quisqualate and kinate type glutamate receptors. It is now known that anything that can make the neuron fire will remove the magnesium blockage of the calcium channel. This is why the channel is called a voltage-sensitive calcium channel, or VSCC. One condition which can cause neurons to fire spontaneously is hypoglycemia, or low blood sugar. In fact, you might have experienced this if you suffer from this condition. The anxiety that you feel as the intense hunger grips you is caused by the hyperactivity of the excitatory neurons in your brain. It is possible that this has survival value in primitive conditions, since it heightens one's senses. In such a primitive setting, this would make it easier to catch wild game. It also intensifies one's courage and anger, as most hypoglycemics know. Again, this makes for a ferocious hunter. So, while magnesium offers considerable protection against overloads of excitotoxins acting on NMDA-type receptor neurons, this protection is reduced when brain energy levels are low, no matter the cause. Earlier I said that the brain protects itself from excessive glutamate accumulation by actively pumping it into special storage sites. This process requires a considerable amount of cellular energy. Should the energy production system fail, these protective mechanisms can no longer operate, causing glutamate to accumulate outside the neuron. It is also known that glutamate causes neurons to become very excited and fire repetitively. This hyperactivity burns up considerable amounts of energy, further depleting ATP stores, thereby causing the cells to die even faster. Once the calcium flows into the neurons, other protective mechanisms that capture calcium within a special structure within the cells, called the endoplasmic reticulum, are thrown into operation in an effort to save the cell. But this intracellular pumping mechanism also requires energy, and lots of it. If the cell is already energy depleted, as with hypoglycemia, or with enzyme defects in the energy production system, this protective mechanism cannot work. The energy-exhausted cells then die. All of this has been demonstrated experimentally in animals and in tissue cultures. For example, when kinate, a substance that stimulates one of the subtypes of glutamate receptors, or LOX, is injected into the brain in microscopic amounts, there is a rapid depletion of brain energy molecules, primarily phosphocreatinine and ATP. Utilizing a special scanning technique called PET scanning that allows scientists to actually watch the brain metabolize energy, similar increases in brain energy utilization have been demonstrated when kinate is injected into special areas of the brain. As we shall see later, this connection between deficiency in brain energy and heightened sensitivity to excitotoxins may play a vital role in human neurodegenerative diseases, in which there is a slow deterioration of brain function. This will also help you to understand how excitotoxins in our food may produce this very same damage, especially during periods of hypoglycemia. Analyzing research data. Since much of what we know about excitotoxins comes from animal research and tissue culture models, it is important that we understand the limitations of this research. Most important, we should also recognize the nature of experimental research in general. The idea that research is always a noble search for truth is naive at best. One need only read Thomas S. Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions to appreciate this statement. As he points out, scientists often acquire the same prejudices of their mentors. They are taught a certain way of looking at the world and of interpreting data that interjects a certain degree of bias. As John Lubbock has said, what we see depends mainly on what we look for. It takes almost a superhuman will to resist the temptation to alter one's data to fit a proposed theory. It is particularly difficult to admit one has been pursuing a false notion after having spent one's life in the pursuit of that idea. Can you imagine dedicating 20 or 30 years studying a phenomenon that is later shown not to even exist? Einstein suffered these pains of denial when the theory of an expanding universe was supported by the finding of background microwave radiation. It was only after he was figuratively clubbed over the head with undeniable evidence that Einstein finally admitted that his static universe model was false. Scientists suffer from the same personality flaws as the rest of us. For the most part, scientists are honest, hard-working, and dedicated professionals who are in search of answers. But many of their weaknesses are subconscious and unintentional. When interpreting experimental studies, it is important to know how the study was done. Sometimes experiments are performed using living animals. These studies are called in vivo studies. More often, especially in neuroscience, small bits of nervous tissue are used instead. This may consist of slices of whole brain, or cells separated and maintained in a special culture medium. Sometimes layers of neurons are grown in special incubators called tissue cultures. These types of studies are called in vitro tests. Both methods have their advantages. While whole animal testing is closer to real life, the in vitro or isolation studies allow us to examine an individual phenomenon without the problem of interfering factors. Using special microtechniques, scientists can now study isolated events inside of cells. For example, cell membranes, mitochondria, and other organelles can be isolated and studied. This is how much of our knowledge of the function of calcium channels came about. But when applying what we have learned, we still must understand how the system works in the whole living organism. For example, when neurons are exposed to glutamate without astrocytes, special glial cells, being present, they are found to be 100 times more sensitive to the toxic effects of this compound. So, in this instance, an experiment conducted to test the sensitivity of neurons to glutamate using tissue cultures containing only neurons would give us a false picture of the sensitivity of these neurons to glutamate in a whole brain by a factor of 100. Yet, man is a very unique species. On some occasions, humans react to certain drugs and chemicals as no other animal. This may be the case with excitotoxins. We know, for example, that the rhesus monkey is more resistant to the toxic effects of excitotoxins than is either man or mouse. This is because of the poor absorption of glutamate in monkeys. And as we have seen, humans concentrate glutamate in their blood following a dose of MSG in higher concentrations than any other species of animal and are more sensitive to the toxic effects of this glutamate than our experimental animals. Thus far, over 70 types of excitotoxins have been discovered. Each of these toxins differs in some unique way. This must be taken into account when interpreting data from experiments. Kinate-type toxins, for example, behave in an entirely different way than NMDA toxins. They affect different types of neurons, and do so in entirely unique ways. Kinate is not normally found in the brain. The route of administration of the excitotoxin is also important in interpreting data. Excitotoxins are given in a multitude of ways. It may be injected directly into specific areas of the brain in microscopic amounts, ingested with food or water, injected into the abdomen, or even painted on the surface of the brain. When given by injection into the abdomen, kinate will cause seizures and destruction of the limbic parts of the brain. But microinjections into specific areas of the brain can produce discrete lesions, often used as functional probes to study brain function. There seems to be some differences in the sensitivity of individual animals to these excitotoxins, even within the same species. For example, some animals require several times the dose of glutamate to produce the same brain cell destruction as in another animal of the exact species, sex, and weight. But then, all living things differ in their sensitivity to toxins. This may be because some cells are naturally stronger than others, or they may have more efficient protective mechanisms, such as the glutamate and calcium channel pumps. We know that the absorption of glutamate from the gut varies considerably from species to species. Humans concentrate ingested glutamate in their plasma in higher concentrations than any known species of animal. Monkeys absorb glutamate very poorly. Mice, while being closer to monkeys in this regard, will concentrate significantly more glutamate following oral feeding of MSG than monkeys. The number of variables is quite numerous. These differences in all animal species, as well as humans, are why some people can smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day for 30 years and never develop lung cancer, while another person develops cancer after only 10 years of lighter smoking. We are all unique individuals created by God. The effect produced also depends on the concentration of the excitotoxin and the duration of exposure. High doses of glutamate can cause rapid cell death, whereas low concentrations may not kill the neurons outright, but can severely injure them. Of considerable interest is the possibility that these low concentrations slowly bring about brain cell death in neurodegenerative diseases of humans. An animal's age is also important. Dr. Olney found that immature animals were 4 times more sensitive to the toxic effects of glutamate than older animals. The opposite may be true of the excitotoxin kinate. When given to 7-day-old mice, little happens. But when given to 21-day-old mice, there is a widespread destruction of neurons. Kinate is also unusual in that it appears to kill neurons some distance from where it is injected. All of these factors must be taken into consideration when comparing experiments and extrapolating or transferring these results to humans. This is especially so where one study seems to contradict another. Often the majority opinion is wrong. Scientific truth is not found by democratic methods or a show of hands. Frequently, the lone iconoclast is found to be correct. Scientific history is replete with such examples. Bias in science. Scientists are human, just like the rest of us. Too often we envision them almost as religious figures, dedicated to a quest for truth and wisdom that is pure and logical. But a closer examination reveals that sometimes they have a weakness for shortcuts to success, dishonesty, distortion of results, faked data, and other forms of deceit. One only needs to survey William Broad and Nicholas Wade's book, Truth, Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science, or Dixie Lee Ray's book, Trashing the Planet, to realize the truth of this statement. In the case of excitotoxins, there is a more pertinent example. When Dr. John Olney discovered the harmful effects of foodborne MSG on the brains of developing animals, he attempted to alert the FDA concerning this danger. He assumed that they would welcome his information with open arms and open minds, but he was soon to learn that government-protected industries can be formidable foes. Dr. Olney stated that soon after he had published the results of his experimental findings on the toxicity of MSG in 1969, he came under tremendous fire from various directions. A multitude of papers were published attacking his data, claiming that when his experiments were repeated in their labs, no toxicity was found. But he found that these detractors all had one thing in common, in that they were all affiliated in one way or another with the glutamate, and or food industries. Further, he noted, one group of food industry apologists wrote an indignant letter to the scientific publication Science, claiming that Dr. Olney's experiments were invalid because he had used baby animals, and baby animals were inappropriate subjects for the study because they had immature enzyme systems that made them especially vulnerable to glutamate toxicity. Incredibly, this was at a time when the food industry was adding large amounts of MSG to baby foods. Their logic escapes the rational mind, unless it is motivated by industrial profits. Dr. Olney, realizing the terrible implications for the health of millions of babies, continued his fight to alert the public and the FDA concerning this danger. The FDA referred this issue to a government-sponsored Food Protection Committee in an effort to resolve the MSG baby food controversy. Along with the food and glutamate industry spokesman, Dr. Olney testified before this committee. Incredibly, the members of this committee seemed more interested in what the food industry spokesman had to say than what a highly respected neuroscientist had to contribute. One spokesman for the food and glutamate industry stated that even if MSG did indeed destroy the arcuate nucleus in the hypothalamus, it didn't matter because it was not known to have functional significance. Yet it was well known at the time that the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus played a vital role in the regulation and release of important hormones from the pituitary. The committee continued to declare MSG safe as a food additive, even in baby foods. Dr. Olney states that at this point he began to look into the backgrounds of the members of the independent FDA committee and discovered that it was founded by, funded by, and totally controlled by the food industry, and that most of the members of the subcommittee appointed to investigate the glutamate baby food issue had strong financial ties with the glutamate and/or food industry. The committee chairman was receiving money from both industries at the time of the committee deliberations. After Dr. Olney described these events to a Senate committee, pressure was exerted upon the FDA to use more objective reviews. But there is little evidence that the FDA has really changed its ways. Dr. George Schwartz discovered that a pamphlet put out by the FDA outlining the consumer facts concerning the safety of MSG as a food additive had in truth been compiled and published by the Glutamate Association, which describes itself as an organization of manufacturers, national marketers, and processed food users of glutamic acid and its salts, including monosodium glutamate. When Dr. Schwartz pointed this out to the FDA authorities, they quietly removed the pamphlet from circulation. But the deception doesn't stop there. Dr. Olney points out that another method used by the industry is to fund numerous studies that purportedly demonstrate the safety of MSG. These studies appear to be carefully designed to avoid finding such neurotoxicity. Interestingly, these studies were published in toxicology journals that are editorially controlled by the very authors of the studies, or their cronies. When challenged in public forums about the safety of MSG in the food, Dr. Olney says, these fellow travelers of the industry merely produce a tall stack of such deceptive studies, and as a result, the more important studies by experienced and highly respected neuroscientists are numerically overwhelmed. Industry spokesmen typically say, the overwhelming number of studies demonstrates no such toxicity. That is, the evidence is weighed by the pound and not by the quality of the work done. Olney notes that over the past 15 years, the FDA has accepted such tainted studies uncritically. It is obvious that the FDA has been captured by the chief MSG manufacturer, the Ajinomoto Company, the food industries, and their public relations organization, the Glutamate Association. By producing a multitude of spurious studies purportedly showing that MSG is safe as a food additive, they can say with impunity, the weight of the scientific evidence demonstrates that MSG is safe for human consumption. The public has the perception that the FDA, being a government organization designed and dedicated to quality assurance and safety, would never allow an unsafe product to be used by the food industry. In fact, most of us assume that the FDA is, if anything, too cautious. This has been the case with their rulings on carcinogenic compounds in the food. They have come under increasing criticism from a number of groups and scientists for using too stringent criteria in such determinations. But in this instance, we have seen that powerful industrial giants have been able to capture a government agency and use it to promote an unsafe product. The following story will help give the reader some idea as to the obstacles that are being faced by those who wish to expose the safety issues involved with MSG and other excitotoxins. In 1971, Dr. W. A. Reynolds and co-workers reported that they were unable to confirm Dr. Olney's previous findings that MSG fed to infant monkeys consistently resulted in injuries to specific areas of the hypothalamus. That is, they found that large doses of MSG fed to newborn monkeys had no toxic effect on infant monkeys' brains. Dr. Olney became suspicious of the study when he realized that they were feeding massive doses of MSG to these infant animals. In his experience, such doses almost always caused the animals to vomit. But if the monkeys did indeed vomit, Dr. Reynolds's data would be completely invalid, since little of the MSG would have actually been absorbed. Later, at a public hearing, Dr. Olney asked Dr. Reynolds if their monkeys vomited. In front of a large audience, she admitted that they had. Yet, a few months later, when the report appeared in Science magazine, no mention was made of vomiting, a critical omission. Dr. Olney wrote Science magazine a letter asking why this vital data was omitted. They referred his letter to Dr. Reynolds. This time, she denied that the animals had ever vomited. 4 years later, Reynolds and others published another paper admitting that the monkeys had vomited after feeding them large doses of MSG. But of even greater importance, for the first time, they admitted that their monkeys were under anesthesia throughout the entire experiment, using a drug called fencyclidine. This powerful anesthetic agent is also one of the most potent antagonists of glutamate receptors known. It is related to MK-801. This drug is known to totally prevent MSG lesions of the hypothalamus. Therefore, their entire experiment was invalid from the beginning. It is hard to believe that they were unaware of this protective effect of fencyclidine. Finally, Dr. Olney pointed out that the photomicrographs of the animal's hypothalamus submitted with the articles were taken from areas of the hypothalamus known not to be affected by MSG. That they knew this was proven by the fact that Dr. Olney invited one of their researchers to observe the MSG-damaged area in his laboratory. The researcher admitted that MSG was indeed causing the lesions. Yet according to Dr. Olney, Dr. Reynolds used this same negative photomicrograph in a subsequent article to prove that MSG was safe. Dr. Olney concluded, "How does one defend the fact that instead of investigating this laboriously, the FDA has uncritically accepted, cited, promoted, and relied heavily on the Reynolds et al. Monkey data as basis for continuing to classify glutamate as GRAS, generally recognized as safe?" Chapter 4. Effect of excitotoxins on the developing brain. There are over 100 billion neurons within the fully developed brain. While this is an enormous number of nerve cells, it is dwarfed by the trillions of fiber connections between these cells. It is these connections that make the brain operate as the wondrous organ that it is. What has puzzled scientists for years is how these connections can come together so flawlessly during embryonic development. After all, most of these trillions of connections must be exact in their location for the brain to function properly. With 100 billion nerve cells, we soon see that there are almost an unlimited number of possible patterns in wiring these cells together. When the brain is miswired, we can see the results in human terms, with such disorders as cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism, learning disorders, and Down syndrome. Recent experiments have shown that stimulation of the brain is one event that is critical to the development and proper wiring of this organ. This stimulation can occur by way of touch, speech, or vision. For example, it has been shown that babies who spend most of the first year of their life lying in a crib undisturbed will develop much slower than babies who are held, cuddled, and talked to. Some of the unstimulated babies could not sit up at age 21 months, and less than 15% could walk by age 3. Experimental studies on the development of the nervous system have shown that the neuron fibers must feel their way along until they find and connect with their target area. For example, the nerve fibers from the eye must migrate along the optic nerve and connect ultimately to the back part of the brain, called the visual cortex. But how can these nerve fibers find their way among so many other fibers and neurons to arrive at the exact neurons controlling vision? Apparently, they use a method very similar to that used by ants. When ants search for food, they first send out a scout. After the scout finds the food, he makes his way back to the nest. On his way back, he will leave a chemical trail for the other ants to follow. It appears that within the brain, there are special cells that also secrete a molecular trail for the axon fiber of the neuron to follow. The neuron's dendrite has specialized growth cones at the tips of its spines that act as a sensor used in following this trail. These growth cones are critical to the normal development and ultimate wiring of the brain. Often, the neuron's first attempt at wiring its pathways is rather crude and inaccurate. To correct this, the growth cone will continuously fine-tune the process. This fine-tuning depends on just the proper amount of stimulation of the neurons. It is known that timing of these events is critical, that the stimulation must occur at just the right moment. Recently, researchers have found that glutamate receptors play a critical role in this development process. In fact, these experiments have clearly shown that glutamate can affect the growth cone itself. In one critical experiment, it was shown that glutamate, in concentrations that were not toxic, could selectively cause the dendrite to shrink, even though the axon, nerve fiber, continued to grow. When the concentration of glutamate was increased to levels known to be lethal to the neuron, even the axon stopped growing. What this means is that glutamate, even in doses not known to be lethal to neurons, can cause this critical brain development mechanism to fail. As a result, this pruning of dendrites can cause the brain to be miswired. This has been shown to occur in the hippocampus, as well as other parts of the brain. The process by which the brain is wired, and even rewired, is referred to as plasticity. This means that the brain is always changing and repairing itself. It is the plasticity of the brain that is critical to learning. We now know that even the brains of adults are constantly changing and being rewired. The main stimulus for this plasticity appears to be by way of neurotransmitters and electrical activity of the neurons themselves. Of all the neurotransmitters playing a role in brain development in the fetus and plasticity in the adult, the most important is glutamate. We know, for instance, that when drugs that block glutamate are placed on the developing visual cortex of animals, their visual system will not develop. But of equal importance is the finding that too much glutamate can cause the same area to be miswired. This could mean that excitotoxin additives used in the food eaten by pregnant women, such as MSG and aspartate, NutraSweet, could cause miswiring of the developing brain of their babies, should these excitotoxins pass through the placenta. It must also be appreciated that the brain at birth is still in a primitive stage of development, and that much of the rewiring process is still going on. In fact, it is suspected that brain development continues even into adulthood. As a result, newborns and toddlers are at a very high risk when exposed to excitotoxic food additives. This exposure does not depend on passage of the glutamate through the placenta. Dr. Stanislav Reines and Jerome M. Goldman recognized this potential danger in their book, The Development of the Brain, when they stated, "It is still a bit unsettling to realize that in the past, monosodium glutamate has been added to commercially prepared infant foods." The excitotoxin food additives not only damage the growth cones of the developing neurons, but also affect development of the brain by acting as powerful stimulants. Previously, I stated that the two most potent stimuli for brain wiring were neurotransmitters, primarily glutamate, and electrical activity or stimulation of the brain. This electrical activity must be present for the brain to develop, but too much activity can cause the development to be misdirected. Excitotoxins, as we have seen, can cause excessive electrical activity of the brain, and can even cause seizures. It is clear that brain development is a very delicate process, involving many specialized events. The timing of these events is also known to be critical, in that there is a specific sequence of events that occurs during development that requires brain stimulation by way of neurotransmitters and electrical activation. Excessive stimulation, as seen with excitotoxins, can severely interfere with this delicate process and possibly lead to learning disorders, emotional illness, or even major psychological disease later in life. Chemical development of the brain. When we consider the biochemical complexity of the brain, the picture becomes almost too difficult to comprehend. Often laymen look at the brain as if it were a static structure, an organ formed before birth that never really changes thereafter. But this is not true. As simple as it may sound, the brain is a living, growing, and expanding organ. All of its parts are alive, and nothing in the brain stays the same. Over a lifetime, the nervous system is replaced biochemically hundreds of times. This means that every part of the brain, the membranes, the genes, the transmitters, the receptors, literally everything that makes up the nervous system is constantly being replaced. There is a continuous turnover of all the chemicals that make up this intricate organ. This is why humans must eat to provide nutrients to replace these vital substances, including vitamins, minerals, and trace elements. The number of chemical reactions taking place in the nervous system at any given time number in the hundreds of thousands. Everything that is broken down in the brain, all of the transmitters generated, every energy reaction, all of the structural proteins and lipids, and the process of interconversions of substances to create other substances occurs via complex biochemical reactions. Anything that upsets this delicate balance can disrupt how the brain develops, and therefore how it will eventually function. So we must also consider the biochemical development of the brain, as well as its structural development. The malleable brain, plasticity. What makes the brain basically different from a computer is that the brain can change its circuits so that it forms new pathways, develops new circuits, and bypasses injured areas. If we examine the dendrites of a neuron, input fibers, we see that they contain hundreds, or in some cases thousands, of tiny spines or bulbs, giving them a hairy appearance under the microscope. These bulbs are contact points between various neuron fibers. The more contact points, the better the circuit works. By comparing the number of dendritic bulbs, scientists have been able to differentiate between smart animals and dumb animals. Naturally, smart animals have a lot more bulbs, or connection points. We also know that the nervous system can repair itself, in a limited way, by sprouting new nerve filaments. We see this in cases of spinal cord injuries, and, to a more limited extent, in brain injuries. Under the microscope, we can see evidence of extensive sprouting by the cut neurons and axons in an attempt to repair themselves. Unfortunately, humans are able to do so only to a limited extent. On a biochemical level, we also see growth and repair mechanisms at work in the nervous system. Most biochemical pathways have alternative methods to achieve the same effect. This double layering of the nervous system adds protection to the system. If, for example, the glucose supply is cut off from the brain, it has a limited capacity to burn fats for energy. In fact, under proper conditions, fats can supply up to 50% of the brain's energy needs. Also, the brain can produce non-essential amino acids and other biochemical raw materials simply by utilizing special emergency biochemical pathways. Neurons are adaptable themselves. For example, they can often secrete more than one type of neurotransmitter, and at times, even change transmitters as required. Also, the number of active receptors on the neuron's membrane can change depending on the temperature and the presence of additional calcium. What this means is that when the animal's brain temperature rises, or if more calcium bathes the brain, the neurons adapt by producing more transmitter receptors, LOX, so as to improve signal conduction. The brain is a very versatile organ, with a multitude of protective mechanisms. This versatility and ability to mold and adapt itself to changing conditions is also a part of the nervous system's plasticity. We know that plasticity of the brain plays a major role in learning. Even while a baby is still within its mother's womb, its brain is being stimulated by sounds, touch, and even light, causing it to change its structure in important ways. Babies move, play with their toes, suck their thumbs, and react to noise after only 6 weeks of development. All of this stimulation induces the pathways in the brain to change and develop. When a calf is first born, its mother licks it thoroughly, as do cats and other mammals. This is not only to remove the amniotic fluid, but also plays a vital role in the development of the newborn's brain. The stimulation of the skin triggers important stimuli within the brain, causing it to develop more fully. This process of molding the brain continues all through life, even into the advanced years. But the majority of this restructuring occurs from the first week after conception to a period as long as 6 or 7 years after birth. This is a critical period. Overstimulation can result in devastating effects on this development. Some neuroscientists feel that excitotoxins added to foods and fed to newborns and young children can result in this type of overstimulation. Sometimes the effects might be subtle, such as a slight case of dyslexia, or more severe, such as frequent outbursts of uncontrollable anger. In fact, injection of minute amounts of glutamate into the hypothalamus of animals has been shown to produce sudden rage. Even more severe cases could result in conditions such as autism, schizophrenia, seizures, and cerebral palsy. There is a possibility that early exposure to excitotoxins could cause a tendency for episodic violence and criminal behavior in later years. While there is no proof that excitotoxin exposure early in life can result in these conditions in humans, there is experimental evidence in animals that such exposure can result in behavioral changes. In one carefully controlled study, 22 rats were given a daily low dose of MSG by injection beneath their skin. The injections began on the first day after birth and continued for 11 days. When the rats were examined, they were found to be shorter and fatter than control animals fed a normal diet. But more importantly, the rats exhibited hyperactive behavior. At first, this would imply that the animals were brighter. But when they were tested in mazes, it was found that they had considerable difficulty escaping from even the simplest maze, whereas all of the control rats were able to escape the mazes in the usual amount of time. In one test, where the rats had to escape an electric shock by jumping up onto a rod suspended over the maze, the MSG-treated rats were never able to learn how to escape. When tested for their ability to discriminate between different types of stimuli, the MSG-treated rats showed significantly more difficulty than the control rats. They concluded that the MSG-treated rats behaved like animals with lower intelligence. It is important to remember that humans concentrate glutamate in their blood to a much greater degree than rats, and they are equally susceptible to its toxic effects once it enters the brain. In an earlier study, Dr. John Olney and Dr. Lawrence Sharp treated a single newborn rhesus monkey with MSG, again given subcutaneously, beneath the skin, by injection. They carefully observed the animal for signs of behavioral problems, but found none. The animal appeared normal. The monkey was then killed and its brain examined. To their surprise, they discovered evidence of significant damage to the animal's hypothalamus, primarily in the area of the arcuate nucleus. This study was important because it demonstrated that brain cells can be destroyed by MSG when given during critical periods of brain development without there being overt signs of brain damage to an outside observer. However, after the animal matures, this damage manifests itself not only in abnormal behavioral functions, but also in problems with other areas of the brain, including endocrine function. Olney and colleagues repeated this experiment on 9 additional rhesus monkeys with identical results. One of the reasons why it is so difficult to convince the FDA bureaucrats of the connection between MSG and delayed brain damage in humans is that it may take years before clinical signs of neurological damage show up. This damage is slow and cumulative, with each dose of MSG or aspartate damaging a number of important brain areas. While a baby exposed to large doses of MSG or other excitotoxins may not show signs of brain damage at birth, the child may do so many years later. We know, for example, that a simple concussion, in which a person is only briefly knocked out, kills a relatively small number of brain cells. But these individuals usually recover completely without any signs of neurological damage. They are completely normal in all ways. Imagine, however, that they were to get knocked out on a regular basis, as happens to some professional boxers. The damage would then tend to accumulate. The result can be a punch-drunk individual who speaks slowly and has difficulty thinking and remembering. But this may take many years to manifest. The same may be true with repeated excitotoxin exposure from food. Each exposure may kill some brain cells, and over many years, a point is reached where the effects of the loss become obvious. It is known that early damage to the frontal lobes of the brain can lead to arrested moral and social development. Our moral development occurs during the early stages of behavioral development and allow us to be able to concentrate and retain what we are taught. It also requires an ability to restrain our desires and emotions, otherwise known as self-control. One study of 2 adults who had suffered damage in early life to both of their frontal lobes demonstrated arrested development and learning disabilities in the realms of insight, foresight, social judgment, empathy, and complex reasoning. It is important to realize that the obvious signs of injury to the frontal lobes of the brain may not become apparent until the child begins to interact with others on a more advanced social level, such as upon entering into school. The end result of exposure to dietary excitotoxins would depend on the severity and duration of the exposure, the age during which exposure occurred, and the child's individual inborn self-control mechanisms. Yet early, even subtle damage to the brain of a developing baby, while silent at the time, could possibly cause severe changes in their personality several decades later. Because of this delayed effect, proving a direct connection to early exposure to excitotoxins in the food would be very difficult.